Tina, it's great to have you on the Bainbridge podcast.
Hey, Ben. It's great to be here. Happy holidays.
Happy holidays. Yes, it's December 20th of 2022. So we're in that coming down from a big year and a big year ahead of us. I've been really excited about this conversation because you have such a unique background. You started at Deloitte in audit. Then you went to a growth equity investor focused on brands. Then you went to CircleUp. So I assume you were still doing sort of equity, but also maybe debt at CircleUp. And now you're at Oats Overnight. So I think it's just like such a cool, rare combination of like accounting, investor, and then back into operator. Tell me about what you're doing at Oats. And why you joined and what your role is.
Yeah, absolutely. I guess if you know, starting 2022, I think I was, you know, very bullish on being a consumer investor for the rest of my life. I still love consumer investing. But over the summer, I kind of picked my head up. You know, the markets obviously have been an interesting time. And having conversations with friends, they said, you know, is this the time to go and explore something else, right? And kind of see what's out there. And there was a company that I sat on the board of that has a lot of investor overlap with Oats. And so those investors, kind of as I communicated, hey, I'm kind of thinking about what's next for me. They were like, we have to meet Brian Tate. As I joke, the Brian Tate, that's his Instagram handle. So, you know, got an opportunity to connect with Brian, and it was just kind of instant, wow, they're building something really, really special here. And I think it's really unique to find founder-CEO combinations that truly can kind of take it through. And I really, with even from our initial call, got that impression of Brian. And so I said, okay, well, this could be interesting to kind of spend some time together, get some experience to operating. Everyone's always said, having that operating lens in investing is great. And so worked kind of 1099 with them for a couple months. Commitment was 20 hours a week. We'll just say it was way more than that. Of course, Brian paid me. But really just fell in love with this company. And then I think Expo East really, which is a big like consumer packaged goods, food conference, kind of getting together with my community, getting the opportunity to talk about Oats, it really solidified it for me that like, this is where I wanted to spend the next stage of my career and that I love what Oats is building. And so joined as chief strategy officer beginning of October, took some time to make that LinkedIn official. But yeah, it's been a great journey. And you know, Oats Overnight is a digitally native business. About 85% of our revenue today is direct to consumer. About 10% Amazon, and then 5% retail. And I think there's so much about Oats that has really excited me. Brian probably being number one, getting to work like very closely with just an amazing founder, visionary, but also executor and CEO. But also I think as you think about oatmeal and the oatmeal category today, I mean, the majority of that is purchased in store. And seeing right. The traction that this business had gotten online and the community that they had built around that was really, really unique. But then also getting to see how the retail case studies were performing and how the brand was performing in store. And this is a little bit of a, you know, we don't need to go down the whole rabbit hole. But I think as you think about omnichannel businesses, it's so challenging to build unique experiences for the customer in each channel. And Oats had a unique challenge in that their direct-to-consumer business is, you know, it's like a blender bottle, and then you've got the pouch, and that is kind of how you interact with the product in D2C. And going to retail, they knew that that wouldn't work, right? You know, having the customer go home and not having a blender bottle, they knew that they needed, you know, a solution that worked better on shelf, and so they came out with their bottle format that they have today, and that only requires water versus their D2C product requires milk. And but all this unique challenge, I think, really built this very unique omni-channel model where they're creating unique experiences for the customer in each channel. And that really excited me. And so I looked at it and I said, wow, this is a fast growing, you know, large business that is really like only at the beginning. I would say, you know, we're 10% up the mountain of what Oats could really be. And I think all of the case study is there. And so the opportunity to jump on board with Brian and build this thing to be a true omni-channel machine was really, really exciting to me. So here I am, end of the year as an operator, new level of urgency, new level of responsibility. I laugh at the questions that I used to ask as an investor. Sorry to every founder that I ever asked questions of. And, you know, I think no matter where my career takes me next, whether it's, you know, staying at Oats for life or operator for life, this experience has just been so unique and just a great one. As I build out kind of what's next for me, I say what's next. I think I will be at Oats for a very long time, just to be clear. I think what we're building is really unique. And, I think you know, people talk about this, that you have that moment in your career, like, wow, this is something that kind of fell into my lap, right place, right time. I have the right skill set to help, right? And I would just be amiss to miss out. And that's definitely how I feel. So made some lemonade out of lemons this year, I guess, if you will.
Nice.
Yeah.
You know, I think there's so many cool things about Oats, but just in case people aren't totally familiar with the brand, I think one of the things that is so interesting is that you have this like incredibly loyal customer base, loves the product, but it takes a little work, right? And
delayed customer satisfaction, right?
Yeah. So, you know, explain a little bit about how the product works, the flavors, you know, the kind of verticalization of the business. I think that's really useful.
Yeah, absolutely. I forget that not everybody knows what even overnight oats are, let alone oats overnight. So oats overnight, you know, our hero product, if you will, it comes in a pouch. And basically you pour our oatmeal into a blender bottle. And then you add milk, and then you shake it up and it sits overnight. And then in the morning you have an easy on the go convenient breakfast, right? High protein. And then, you know, all natural ingredients, healthy, better for you breakfast. What we're doing really uniquely from a flavor perspective is we are creating, innovation at a rate that I think nobody else in the category is doing. Mm-hmm. So if you take a step back and you think about breakfast, right? So breakfast is, you know, for right or wrong, Americans think that breakfast is the most important meal of the day. But the majority of Americans don't actually eat breakfast. And I think that's really for two reasons. One, there aren't a lot of convenient solutions. And then of the convenient solutions, right? It's a lot of chocolate peanut butter bars or blueberry almond bars, right? So it gets bland and boring pretty quickly. And so what Oats is doing is kind of solving both of those. So yes, there is a delay, right? You prepare it at night. It takes you about 15 seconds. You put it in your fridge. But in the morning, it's ready to go. I have a 14-month-old. I quite literally grab my breakfast out of the fridge on the go as my little one is throwing her passy at me. You know, we solve that convenient format. The other thing I'll say too is like, this is a drinkable product. So, you know, ditch the spoon. It's completely unique. But what does that mean? It is very much on the go, right? So I think you look at bars, even like when I'm eating, you know, any bar today, right? I'm trying to open that as I'm driving. I'm trying to get to daycare. I'm taking a work call. There's just too much going on. But Oats is just quite literally, you know, taking a sip as I'm running through the red light. you know, the convenience I think is really clear in how we solve that. And I think, yes, there's some prep and involved, but the customer also with that comes anticipation. And I think as you look at our community and what they tell us is like they wake up in the morning excited to eat their breakfast.
That's cool.
And I think there's an element of having to prepare it at night that creates that experience.
Yeah, that's good.
So, you know, that's the first part of it. But then the second part is flavor, right? So what Brian did very early on is we're vertically integrated. So we own our own factory in Tempe, Arizona. We have an amazing COO, Vincent Comerford. Literally could not run this without him. But that was really done because there's nobody in the industry that's really set up to create products the way we do, just because, you know, there's your oat base, then there's your like protein powder, but then there's also like your mix-ins, right? And so that could be like, for instance, like our mango custard skew, right? That's like little chunks of mango, right, in there with your oats. And as you look at a lot of the co-manufacturing options out there today, you know, they can't really process that mix-in portion for us. And so we've been able to create a really unique and proprietary manufacturing process, which I think is great for exit. But the reality is, and Brian might hate me for saying this specifically on a podcast, but the reality is, you know, that could be replicated at any time. It would take money and it would take time, but it could be replicated. But what we've done to really build a moat around this is we've heavily invested in an R&D team. So we have a 5-person R&D team, which means that we're able to launch new flavors every single month. And so what does that do? That solves the second problem that we talked about. And kind of my thesis in breakfast, the biggest problem is just the mundaneness of it, right? And not getting that variety. And yes, people might be drawn to a specific format, but they're tired of eating chocolate peanut butter. And so they just stop eating breakfast, or worse, you know, they go to a quick service restaurant to have something that's in no way healthy at all. And so we've been able to create, now we have over 30 flavors. We have things like s'mores and fruity cereal and, you know, classics like apple cinnamon. And I think as you think about, it's really interesting too, like as you think about the coast versus, you know, the middle America, there's different taste preferences, right? Some people want lower sugar options. Some people want higher sugar options. A lot of people want dessert for breakfast, right? They are super excited about our Boston cream pie or our birthday cake. And then there's, you know, people like my husband that just, you know, want something like apple cinnamon so they can have a little bit of flavor in their day and take on the day. And so, you know, we are able to create that uniqueness and attract customers from across the country, no matter what their flavor profile are. And the output of this, and really our secret sauce is, you know, we're getting consumer feedback as we're developing these flavors. And I think quite literally the intent of that was just to create a good products, right, at the end of the day. Yeah. And what's the best way to create good products? Get consumer feedback, get feedback from people. But the byproduct of it is really community. And I think that is really exciting when you've created something that the customer feels like they are a part of, really and truly. There's just a different level of loyalty that you see versus other brands. And I think while we were quite literally solving like a very practical issue in the breakfast category, we're on to something much bigger. With this consumer feedback loop, and excited to be a part of that, be a part of the strategy going forward and how we think about executing against that loop in retail and other channel. Because, you know, that's going to be a challenge of continuing that throughput. But we're excited to tackle that challenge. And I think we've got some great ideas. And, you know, 2023 is going to be a big one. And I'm excited for it. Hopefully I just went on a long tangent, but
no, it's awesome. Well, actually that leads to a great segue of like, how do you think brands or oats specifically, or another brand crosses that bridge, right? So you have this like, you know, building a community online, like, oh, we have emails and social and like all sorts of tools that we can do that. Not saying it's easy. But if somebody's grabbing you off the shelf at Target, how do you start community?
Yeah. Yeah. And how do you think about that? Yeah. So I think, you know, community is such an interesting word. It's like a buzzword, you know, being a consumer investor, you know, the number of founders that were like, oh, we have a community. We have a community, our community, right? So what does that actually mean? So I think to me, community means somebody who's actively engaged. So we get 1,000 comments a day in our community. And that's about oatmeal. So an engaged community is something that really means something. And I think you get an engaged community really to, in my opinion, there's like three prongs to it. One, you have to be solving some sort of customer problem, right? That's the definition of any brand. Two, you have to have a good solution for that problem and quite literally a good product. So if it's food, it has to taste good, right? So if it's, if you're solving for, you know, say I have a keto product, right? I'm solving, hey, there aren't a lot of good keto snacks out there and customers that are trying to be keto. Like you got to also have a good product, right? Because at the end of the day, customers aren't going to come back even if there is like a nutritional element to your product that creates something harder to make something good. And I think that's where a lot of brands have been challenged. But three, you have to create passion around your product. And I think that's where community and engagement comes in. And, you know, there's a lot of brands that have created passion in very unique and different ways. You know, I think of brands like Topicals in the skincare space, where they've done, you know, incredible things and activations, I guess you would call them digitally, to get their customers involved in the brand and feel like they have an emotional connection to the brand. Oats has done their, you know, our community feedback program, which has led to engagement and passion around what we're building. People like Patagonia, right? Their tenets as a company and how they speak and how they act goes way beyond their product. And then, you know, you have the tailwinds of people just wanting to wear that product. And when you have cool people wearing the product, and then every student, sooner rather than later, every investment banker is wearing the product, right? And it becomes a thing. So I think it really comes down to passion, and you can unlock passion in multiple different ways and build community, but it's really challenging and there has to be like a reason for it.
Interesting. Yeah, when you're giving that example, you're like, okay, well, how many people, you know, are going to be like, you know, want to talk about their oatmeal? And you're like, oh, if you frame it that way, you're like, well, probably not many. There's probably some that are like, hey, I love this flavor. But when you sort of broaden it out, like you did with that Patagonia example, it's like, you're so right. Like, it's not like, I don't know. Okay, hey, this fleece is awesome. You know, what else do I have to say about it? But Patagonia has now embodied this incredible ethos, right? Very much owns that ethos. You know, if you believe what Patagonia believes, then you are almost automatically in that. So how does, like, what is the kind of broader thing for oats? Is it breakfast? Is it nutrition? Is it like, where's that additional outer layer?
I think what we found is just that consumers are not being heard today. Right? They don't get the opportunity to feel like they're truly a part of the product building process. And so I think what we have found is we are elevating the opinion. So like, if you look at our community, we love negative feedback. That's just as valuable as positive feedback, right? The, you know, our FID right now is matcha mango. So our flavor and development that we're testing out with our 70,000 subscribers is matcha mango. You know, matcha is a pretty polarizing flavor. Our engagement has been really high because people are all over the place, right? They're saying, if you don't like matcha normally, don't comment because I love matcha and I need this to be skewed and this is great, to the, you know, I absolutely hate matcha. Don't ever launch this flavor. This is, you know, gross. to I don't get enough mango, to, you know, and everything in between, right? Oh, the mango pieces aren't elevated enough. And I think the key for us is we get that feedback, but then we communicate what that looks like. So, you know, let's let's say we do launch Matcha Mango, right? There'll be some iteration to that formula based on all the feedback we got. And we'll communicate to the customer, right? We heard you. We elevated the number of mango pieces in there because there wasn't enough mango.
Yeah.
Or we dialed up the matcha. Or, you know, last month our FID failed. Like, it was the lowest response rate and the lowest scoring flavor that we've ever launched. It was chocolate covered pretzel. We learned something really valuable. If you're going to launch chocolate covered pretzel, there better be pretzel pieces in it. And so we have some work to do on how do you let pretzel pieces not, you know, sog overnight. But
right.
We went back to our customers and said, we heard you. Like, we failed. And the response from our consumers was honestly just as passionate and excited as when, you know, the month before we had launched coconut cream pie, and that was our highest rated SKU that we'd ever done, right? And we had said, it's amazing, you know, and they're all, you know, in our community, when is coconut cream pie coming out, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
But so I think it's creating a true feedback loop. And quite honestly, like, most people can't do what we're able to do because we're vertically integrated. And I think we've done a really good job of perfecting what our voice is.
Yeah.
And, you know, how we talk to the customer. So I think, you know, long term, we're in breakfast, but we could be in other categories. And I think the one thing that excited me, and sometimes I roll my eyes a little bit at this, but we have the opportunity to be like the next strategic in food, quite literally, with this strategy, right? Like, we do. I'm not saying that's what we do, but like, we're on to something as far as how consumers respond when they're included in that innovation process. And so we're excited to see where that goes and what that looks like.
Yeah. Yeah. That makes so much sense. Cause I was imagining while you were talking, like, you know, what would happen if you tweeted at Quaker Oats or, you know, sent them an email, like, you might get a response, but it's like, here's more cinnamon apple for you. You know, like, they're not going to roll out a new flavor for it. Yeah. That's really powerful. So Oats is like, you know, this powerhouse has a big future that could go past oats or overnight oats. What are some of the things that you've in your career, I mean, you've had the chance to look at and invest in and talk to so many brands. What do you think makes for a great brand? You know, what is that, a definition of a great brand?
Yeah, definition of a great brand. Man, that's such a like loaded, exciting question. The definition in my mind of a great brand is I want to be the brand that when somebody asks you, what have you tried that tastes good this week, we're at the top of the list every time. And so I think the definition of a great brand is the brand that your customers are your number one sellers, right? Because they're out there pushing your product every single day because they love it, they believe in it. So that's everything from, you know, Rothy's to Modern Fertility to, you know, Patagonia, right? And there's different reasons why those brands are at the top of that household's, what I like to say, on the top of their tongue, right? I want to be on the tip of the tongue. But I think that that's like ultimately like the North Star, right? You want to be a household name that people are just talking about and they're avidly excited about. I think how you get there, there's a lot of different ways to get there, but it comes down to like those three tenets I think every single brand has, which is, one, they're solving a problem, right? There's something new that they're doing. They have an excellent product and they've been able to unlock passion behind that product and that brand. And I think at the end of the day, sometimes an amazing brand is highly correlated with an individual product. And sometimes a brand is highly correlated with a concept, right? So like, of course, Patagonia, first thing that your mind goes to is probably the jacket, right? But outside of that, it's the broader ethos that you spoke to. So that is an excellent brand. But then, you know, I think about, you know, Rothy's, right? And I think about, when I think about Rothy's, I think about the shoes. I understand that, you know, they've innovated into other things, but they will always, in my mind, be highly correlated with shoes. And I think that's okay too. And I think where we're at on our journey is how far do we take this? And is Oats Overnight, and, you know, potentially we rebrand in the future, who knows, wink, wink. But like, is Oats Overnight, like, are we going to be always associated with oats, or are we going to be associated with something bigger?
Yeah.
And I think that's a delicate balance that a lot of brands struggle with. And I've seen a lot of brands try to become bigger and more, and it backfire.
Right.
Because they're not listening to their customer. And so I think for us, as you think about like our biggest challenge, that will be our biggest challenge going forward is how far do we push the envelope, and making sure that we're constantly checking back with our customer and making sure that the story makes sense, that the excitement is there.
Yeah.
Because we have something so unique today, and Oats Overnight is going to be a huge brand unto itself. And so as we think about future innovation, future category expansion, all of that, making sure we're going back to what does the customer think and what does the consumer think, and are we pushing the envelope too far or not?
Right.
And I think that's, for every good brand, that's like the, I've seen a lot of brands that have, you know, not been able to push that envelope or tried to push that envelope and lost who they are in the process. And, you know, gone from a good brand to an okay brand, when they could have gone to a good brand to a great brand, but in a more limited product scope. So,
Anyways,
I don't know if that fully answers your question, but it's something that's top of mind for me right now.
Yeah. Well, I do think that's an interesting distinction that you just made, which is, you know, there's a natural tendency to try to expand the brand, you know, expand the SKUs, attract a bigger audience. But then there is a, there's a sort of alternate, which is like, no, this is who we are. And we're just going to, you know, be something within that, that space. And then, cause you can certainly see examples of both of those. It's, you know, one thing that's has struck me from conversations recently is like the timing, right? Time. Mm-hmm. You know, I think that we can't, are coming out of the sort of end of this period where like, oh, you know, I can build a great brand in, 3 years, right? Like, I mean, we're talking about Patagonia a lot. It took 50 years, right, to build to where they got. Like, what do you think about time? Like, is there just like a, you know, hey, it just takes a while, or can you really accelerate that? Or, you know, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, I think, you know, we're coming out of like the age of digital, right? Where you quite literally had, you know, 20 to 30 major brands that popped up in under a 5-year timeline, right? And they were able to do that because it was pre-iOS. CACs were at an all-time low, and the customer was at an all-time high of wanting to experience products digitally. I mean, quite literally, if you look at the home category, I mean, that went through the roof in COVID, right? There were great brands that were built out of that. And so, but I think we're coming into like the next cycle of brand and what that means. And I think there's a few things that are happening all at the same time. You know, you have Gen Z that is becoming a share of wallet.
Mm-hmm.
They experience and have preferences on brand in a different way than millennials do. You have, you know, obviously we are still dealing with COVID, and we'll still be dealing with it, I think, 5-10 years down the road. Mm-hmm. But in, you know, what I like to consider kind of our post-COVID height era, right? We're also dealing with, you know, most likely a recession of some kind. I think that's pretty much written in the stars at this point. And so you have a lot of really interesting consumer behaviors that are all triangulating at the same time. And then probably the fourth and most important one too is, you know, post iOS, right? That completely changed the way that brands were able to engage and target customers effectively, right? So you've got these four main trends that are all triangulating at the same time that I think are going to push people back to omnichannel in a way that's a lot more significant. I think omnichannel was a big buzzword like 2-3 years ago when people kind of saw the writing on the stars. But I really think that this is like the only way that brands are going to be built in the future. I don't think that digital is dead in any way. Quite literally, I work at a big, you know, digital brand. But I think that the way that customers want to interact with brands is in, you know, multiple channels. And I think being able to scale in multiple channels takes a little bit more time and a little bit more resource. So of course there will be brands that have that, you know, 5-year, trajectory, right? And it's all relative. What's big to you? Is 50 million in 5 years huge, or is 150 million, right? Yeah. But I think there will be, you know, a few that break out that way. But I think that the path to building brand significance is that timeline is longer today.
Yeah.
And I think that that's why, one of the reasons that I think venture capital and consumers specifically have realized, okay, return generation in this category looks a little bit different. And as a result, multiples have to come down, because quite literally it takes longer to build a significant brand.
Right.
I actually am of the mindset of like, this is a great thing, because I think it's going to force people to build businesses. Whereas before, we were building brands. And I think, you know, brands are amazing. I quite literally spent the majority of my career in brands, and I will always be a brand person. But I think for a while it was building a brand, and now it's building a branded business. And I think that's going to be really important as we think about the next stage of like, what is consumer? And, you know, I would say one of the things that attracted me to Oats is they have found a way to stay relevant digitally post iOS. And again, that comes back to those three tenets: solving a problem, having a good product, and having a community that's passionate behind it. And I think if you have those things, you can tackle all these obstacles that are ahead of you, and continue to grow at a rapid rate. But it's going to force people to have those three things, because if you don't, I don't know how you scale, and certainly quickly.
I love that building a business as opposed to just building a brand, you know, because that I think leads to a topic that you and I both really enjoy. It's a little wonky, but financial modeling.
I love a financial model, Ben. I love it. Well, first of all, like, shameless plug for Ben and Austin over here, but they are amazing. The tool that they're building at Bainbridge is really, really unique. And I think for somebody like us that, you know, we have 70,000 subscribers, we're a pretty decent sized business. We have multiple segments of our business, multiple segments of even our digital business, right? Subscriber, non-subscriber, all of that, that we're trying to understand. And they've built a really amazing tool that allows us to seamlessly understand performance versus a forecast, but also understand, you know, scenario planning, right? If we move to a 30% discount at first offer, like, what does that quite literally do to our P&L? Because I think for so long, businesses, specifically in digital, have been very focused on cohorts and cohort building. And I think that's important. Like, if you don't understand how your cohorts perform, that is a huge miss. But, you know, what I saw in VC all the time, and, you know, even saw in Oats to an extent, is like, how do you connect that performance to an actual P&L and like the actual cash flow operations of a business? And so, shameless plug, but Bainbridge has been a huge resource for us in doing that. And I think you didn't ask me the question yet, Ben, but I'm sure you would. Like, I think that is the most important thing as you're building a digital business, is being able to take that cohort performance and interpolate that or extrapolate that onto a financial statement to truly understand what that means for the, you know, the core of your business, which is your cash flow and your EBITDA.
Well, thank you for that. That was awesome. I really appreciate that. We've really enjoyed working with you guys. And I think, you know, one of the reasons we've really enjoyed working with you guys is because the more complex the problems are, the kind of more interesting they are to try to solve. And then, you know, the higher the stakes can be. So it's really fun to have a partner that recognizes the complexity, has the ambition to like, I want to find a way to be better. So it's really, you know, gratifying. So thank you. You talked about the cash flow and you talked about the cohorts and the margin. Why do you think it is, you know, if you sort of take a step back, maybe not just Oats, but across your career, you know, what is it that makes these businesses so hard to model or understand and ultimately run and improve? Like, what do you think you're getting in the way?
Yeah, it's a great question. One, I have so much respect for every single entrepreneur that has started a business the past 5 years because, you know, COVID was brutal, iOS was brutal. Like, there has just been so much that has happened that, you know, we didn't really have a line of sight to, and we didn't know how the consumer was going to respond. And I think that is just a challenge unto itself. And that's where I think it's important to have a tool and have a model that you can quickly change inputs and run scenarios. And I think that's how a lot of founders survived the past 5 years, is because they've been able to quickly adjust what their business model looked like depending upon, like, you know, what was the obstacle that presented that day. So I think that's first, but I think, I think that's super important. I think in general, as you think about financial modeling, a lot of people get scared by, like, just the word financial modeling. They think, I'm not a finance person, or I'm not an accountant. This is highly technical. Like, how do I do this? And I think the reality is, and actually I was like having this conversation with Brian the other day, because Brian was like, you know, Brian was a professional poker player. He, before this, like, he, you know, he did not go to college, right? Like, he is the smartest person that I know, but, like, has never been in an accounting class. Right. And he said, a lot of this is intuitive after building a business. Like, I understand how cash is flowing in and out of our business. And so having a model that helps me predict how it's going to flow in and out in the future, and have something for my team that I can say, these are our goals, and do we hit those goals or not? So I think it's actually way less intimidating than people actually think. And I think it just takes that, you know, that day that you carve out of your schedule and just say, I'm going to do nothing else but understand the financial statements of my business and what are the key inputs to that, right? And I think that every business needs to do that. And then if they haven't, every business owner hasn't done that. And I know a day is a lot. It's a lot of time, right? I get it. I, you know, quite literally 5 minutes feels like a lot of time these days to dedicate to anything. But that is, like, the key to building a strong business. And specifically in consumer packaged goods, it's the key to surviving, because businesses are going to need to be EBITDA positive before they exit. They're going to need to be margin accretive to the category of whatever strategic acquires them. Yeah. And so understanding the levers of your business and how you can influence those levers is, like, really, really important. And I guess in CPG, those levers are, you know, revenue, gross margin, and EBITDA. Yeah. And then what is your cash cycle, right? And that cash cycle becomes less important at exit, but understanding until you're profitable what that cash cycle is and how you finance that cash cycle.
Yeah.
I don't know that I answered your question, Ben, but
no, it was great. It was interesting because I was a little surprised when you started how you focused on the rapid scenario planning. Why is that so important in your mind? I agree with you, but I'm curious why you started there.
Yeah, I think so. Like, you know, prior to Oats, I was a consumer venture capitalist, you know, sat on the board of a lot of companies. All of these companies had budgets, right?
Yeah.
But what we know when you're growing a business is your budget becomes a little bit dated almost a month into the business, right? And I think what a lot of founders have is they don't feel like they have the time in the day to scenario plan, and then they just make business decisions and strategic decisions on where to take the business without understanding how that impacts the financial statements.
Yeah.
And I think 2 years ago when we were in the bullish market, we had the luxury of doing that.
Right.
But today in the market that we're at, and where venture capitalists are at, and where investors are at in general, as a founder, you need to understand how every major strategic decision is going to impact your P&L and and understand what the levers are to that before you make that decision, or right. at least have a projection on what that's going to look like. Because I mean, it's high stakes today, and it's high yeah. stakes to get EBITDA, and it's high stakes to get gross margin, and not thinking through those and having a, you know, 500K misstep could quite literally mean, I don't mean to be a doomsday killer here, but it's kind of true. Like, it literally could mean the death of your business.
Absolutely.
And so I think in this day, it's the most important. 4 years ago, it was like budget, what's our budget? I mean, for Oats, obviously we're setting a budget. We're going to hold ourselves to that budget, and we have KPIs and OKRs tied into that budget, all those things. It's yeah. extremely important. But like, you at any point should know what your budget should be, right? Because you're running scenarios so frequently that you know, hey, this is my current outlook on my business and what it looks like.
So when you say strategic, you know, I think sometimes people can think like, oh, do I, you know, go into Target or Amazon, or, you know, do I raise this big round? But I think you're using the word strategic more like, you know, hey, do we let CACs go to here or?
Yes. I mean, strategic as in like, do we let CACs go to here? Do we increase spend to here? Do we change our discount at first offer to here? Do we add a free gift with purchase? Do we launch a new product category? Do we, you know, another good one is, do we go into Target, right? Understanding what that margin looks like. But I mean, quite literally anything that if you were talking to a potential investor, you would be excited about, like, oh, we're doing this as a business because it's going to impact our cohorts, or it's going to impact this.
Yeah.
You should be able to speak to what that business decision does to your P&L and to your balance sheet.
Yeah.
Or you think it will. Right. Because also that's your way of judging whether it was successful or not. I mean, I sat on the board of companies that would do like, let's just use the example of like a free gift with purchase or a discount offer. And they were excited by it. And we saw like take rate go through the roof. And it took 4 or 5 months to realize, oh, wait, this is actually not a positive like customer for us. Right. Like we're discounting too much. We don't break even for 12 months. This does not make sense, right? And I think that's fine because that was like the market that we were in a few years ago. But today, like we're not in that market. And so having tools that you know quite literally 60 days in, was that the right D2C decision or not? Or, you know, I mean, retail's a lot different, right? Like retail's a long cycle, all of that. But I think understanding what your price is as you go into each retailer, how you stay price competitive in all the different channels, how you stay margin neutral, right? Like going through KeHE and Unify, that margin structure looks very different than going direct to, say, a Walmart or a Target. What the velocities are at different channels, you know, how you create unique experiences at each customer. You know, there's a lot into retail. There's less, like, you can't like pick at it in the same way. But, you know, there are a lot of companies as well that, you know, we're just like, oh, we won Target, so let's go.
Right.
And I think you need to understand what that does to your margin. Is it is it positive? Is it negative? If it's negative, is there a way to get that positive in the future? Maybe it's negative, but it's going to drive revenue up so much that your incremental dollars to the bottom line is worth it, right? It's about knowing all those, or having ideas of what all that looks like before.
Yeah. That's really interesting. Cause like your decisions are, they're like the kind of week to week decisions that companies are having to make, leadership is having to make, you know. And then what do you think like the ideal, you know, we've kind of experienced or heard, you know, that finance has kind of been de-emphasized inside the, you know, brands, marketing's been emphasized. It makes sense, you know, over the past year, past years. What do you think that ideal decision-making structure looks like in a brand? You know, you know, hey, I'm at 200,000 of sales, but, you know, kind of Oats level sales.
Like, It's an interesting question, Ben, because like you and I have quite literally had this conversation, right? Like how do we like org our finance department? What does that look like? So today, you know, you've got our CEO, Brian Tate, CEO and founder. Yeah. I'm our chief strategy officer. And then you've got Vincent, who's our COO. That is right. Our C-suite. That will be our C-suite for quite some time. The reason that we don't feel like we need like a full-time CFO is that we feel like between Brian and myself and people like Bainbridge, and then we have like an outsourced accounting CFO group that we use, yeah, that have also been great and instrumental. But we feel like between Brian and myself, we have the internal capacity and capability to understand what inputs do we want to change? What's the strategy behind mm-hmm. how we're looking at this scenario of the model? And mm-hmm. then, you know, with people like Bainbridge and AJ, we have the tools to mm-hmm. Execute on that. I think if you are an organization and a founder that is not financially savvy or feels comfortable in that realm, I think it's an incredibly important hire to make because you need just as much as you need marketing. You need that person that is close to your financials and business performance because they quite literally are the person that's going to raise their hand and say, hey, that's going to cost us $500,000 of capital, and we have $1.5 million of capital. And as we think about going out to fundraise, that's not going to give us enough cushion. And so we yeah. need, I understand that's going to raise revenue, but that comes at a cost, right? Yeah. And Brian and I have this discussion all the time around, you know, look, our CACs are great and our CACs are stabilized. When do we step up in that marketing, that monthly marketing spend, right? Because right. there's a cost to that. Our current payback periods are somewhere between like 4 and 5 months, right? We're not going right. to see that step up come back through our financials for 4 to 5 months. And are we at a place where we're like ready to spend that? So I think it's a hire that's been de-emphasized, but it's incredibly important. But I guess I'm a proponent of, you don't need somebody that is that, you know, high power CFO. There are lots of ways to get to this problem. And so finding for your company, who that person is for Oats, it's me and Brian that own that, right? You know, it's funny also with my background, a lot of people are like, oh, are you the CFO? And I'm like, no, I'm not only the CFO. I have other roles and responsibilities. But I do think it's incredibly important. It needs to be just as emphasized as marketing in today's cycle. So,
yeah, I think, you know, one other area that I think you'll have some real experience in is like, you know, the difference between when you see a company come in, founder or team come in, and they're able to answer those questions of like, well, we considered this and we considered this other thing. We ran these scenarios and then this, here's the range of outcomes, but we chose, you know, option A, right? Like, or the company that's like, yeah, we chose option A. It was awesome. Like how much does that change your perspective on the company when you see that somebody really has a handle on their data and their finance versus, you know, the more seat of the pants like guys?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, for me, that was like the difference between investment and not investment.
Oh, really?
Quite literally. Like there's a lot going on, and are Brian and I the best at running every single model and every single scenario? No. But I think people that understand how business decisions are going to impact their financial statements, that are talking through these things as a team. I mean, Oats, like personally, like we had a conversation with a amazing private equity firm in the space that is, you know, still looking at, you know, potentially investing in our business. But for them, they're like, look, we love the forecast, but like, what are the other scenarios? And we were like, oh, okay, we're going to open the hood. And we just told them everything. We said, look, like, this is how we're building retail to happen next year. But there are like some other scenarios where it looks like this and it looks like this. And we're talking through strategies of like, do we do this? Do we do this? Right? This isn't like a hard quoted number that we just like came up with. Right? And I think for them, that like completely changed the tone of like the opportunity to invest, what that looks like, all of that. Because for them, they were like, oh, okay, you guys really get it. You understand that,
right,
you know, a forecast is just a forecast and that there's a lot of scenarios in between there. And, you know, when you're building a forecast for fundraising specifically, it's literally my least favorite thing to do. I hate it because you've got investors that want growth at all costs. You've got investors that are like, I want to see EBITDA first. You've got investors that are somewhere in between. You've got investors that don't know what the heck they want. And then when, yeah, you change something, they're like, oh, well, now you're this. Like, what?
Yeah. They're going to bring that model out 2 years later. Like, hey, why aren't you here?
Yes, exactly. And then, like, what do the out years look like, right? Like, it's just a whole song and dance that I absolutely hated on both sides of it. But I encourage founders when they can to have those honest conversations with investors, because I think two things. One, you're going to attract like the best investors out there if they're ones that are willing to have those conversations with you, yeah, at entry, because the reality is your bullish forecast in some way or another is not going to transpire in some way or another. Yeah. You might grow faster and spend more cash. You might grow slower and spend less cash. Like, you might hit your first 2 years, but your third year looks completely different, right? Like, something is going to be different. And so having those conversations early and often is great. But two, I think it also communicates to investors that you understand how every decision you're making as a business impacts the financial statements.
Yeah.
And at the end of the day, increasingly financial statements are the most important thing that investors are digging into, because,
yeah,
they need to see growth, they need to see incrementality, and they need to see EBITDA. And, you know, every single company out there, including Oats, says we're going to be break even next year. And, you know, being able to really have discussions around why and what that looks like and the scenarios to get there, I think sets you up for success in fundraising, yeah, in a different way. So
I wish that founders, you know, the founders that we work with, even if they aren't raising, could go have conversations like that with PE funds. And I know the PE funds have no interest in spending their time doing that. But the level of rigor and sophistication in the modeling and the data analysis and the questions and the pattern recognition, like, can't help but make you into a better operator, you know?
Yeah.
And totally. I just think, like, unfortunately, too many people, like, the first time they're having that conversation, it's like almost too late, right? They're like, I'm not ready. Like, oh, it's clear I'm not ready. They ask me a question, I don't even know what that means, right?
Right.
Or like, I can get that data to you, but it's going to be a month from now. It's like just that. So having that forcing function would be so useful, you know, for people to kind of like get a shock to the system. Like, oh, we need to clean this up.
Yeah. It's a passion project of mine. When I find more time, Ben, I've always thought about, you know, almost like an advisory, but also just like giving back to the community of just,
ooh, that's
like,
a good idea.
Yeah. I'm having these like candid conversation about models and what they look like and,
yeah,
what they're doing for your business. Cause I think there's so much support out there for fundraising and what should your deck look like? And like, right, all those really important things. But I think the thing that's been missed the most from the venture community and the founder community is like bridging the gap and like having these discussions about like really and truly, like, what do your business fundamentals look like and what are the different scenarios to get to,
yeah,
whatever objective you're talking to.
Yeah.
And I think the best fundraisers are able to have those conversations. And then I think a lot of founders try to have those conversations and they're not received well, for various reasons. But I think it's mainly because they come across as being too wishy-washy. And so I think there is like an art in having these conversations and,
yeah,
having founders communicate them.
Yeah. Nina, thanks so much. This is really fun. I really enjoyed our conversation.
Yes. Thank you. And like I said, happy holidays.